Today in a special episode, we will be interviewing Graham Clark, co-host of Stop Podcasting Yourself, and we'll be discussing allergies and allergy bullying. This is Doctor versus Comedian. I'm Dr. Asif Doja, and this is the Doctor of Laughs.
Not a real doctor.
Ali Hassan. Now, every episode, I pick a topic for Ali from comedy and entertainment, and I question him about it. Then Ali picks a topic from medicine and health and grills me on that topic. But today is a special episode. Today, we'll be interviewing Graham Clark, co-host of the hit podcast, Stop Podcasting Yourself. And then later, Graham will stay with us, and we'll be discussing allergies and allergy bullying.
Well, let's get right into it. Very, very excited to have comedian, producer, podcaster. And it goes in that order because he was a comedian first. Actually, he was a baby first. First, he was a baby. Then he became a skateboarder. If the image of him in doing his comedy now is any indication, you look like right out of the skate park. But comedian, producer, and podcaster. Three-time Canadian Comedy Award winner, by the way. That's a big deal around these parts. And you host, of course, this fantastic podcast with your buddy Dave Shumka, who was a comedian for a long time as well. I believe he now spits in the face of comedy, but that's his own journey going on. But yeah, the co-host of Stop Podcasting Yourself and much, much more that we will get into. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, clap in your own homes and your cars right now for Graham Clark.
Thank you. Thank you for all your applause.
I love that you paused. You paused for the clapping because you're confident that they're doing
it. Yes,
that.
Of course. Why ask for it if you're not going to get it, you know?
I think there's like three people who are like, I guess. No, you will not regret. Like Walmart, you will not regret clapping. Having clapped. That was
That was a good feeling. And it felt good over here. And I hope it felt good out there doing it.
I should have done it too, just to encourage it. Why wouldn't I clap? Why would I just command others?
That's the worst part.
It's true. You're my co-host. Why didn't you clap, Asif? Everyone is suspect right now, except for Graham.
That's right. Thank you.
Graham, why don't we start off? On our podcast, we ask people something called the origin story, which is...
Trademark, original term made by us. No one can copy it.
That's right.
But on your podcast, Stop Podcasting Yourself, you guys call it Getting to Know Us.
Yes.
And you have a, you know, so we will do a little Getting to Know Us segment here. We won't use your music because it's probably copyraighted and then we'll get
into it. Yeah, we don't want to lose that.
But we want to get to know you. Yeah, exactly.
Also, we're
he's a litigious.
We're original podcasting minds over here, Asif. We don't need to use anybody else's anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So we'll call it either Getting to Know Us or Origin Story. So just tell us a little about, you know, kind of your early life and what kind of led you into comedy.
Early life, I burst forth out of a birth canal like a kid going on a water slide. And then it's been downhill ever since. That was the top thing. I'm from Calgary, Alberta, and I was born and raised there and always wanted to be a comedian, even as a little kid. Always thought that was just like a super like important thing to be. And I was I wanted to do that ever since. I can't remember what it was, but I remember seeing a busker and he was so funny. And I was like, oh, how do you get into that? You know, like he would juggle and stuff like that. I didn't think, I was like, what could I do that doesn't have all that part, but does the part where he's like a funny guy? And then I moved out to Vancouver. And went to film school and then was trying to get started in film. And then there was an industry-wide actor strike and I believe a writer strike too. So the whole industry ground to a halt. And so nobody was working. So then I drifted into other things because it was more than a year where all this stuff went away. And then when they started gearing up again, it took a year to get back up to speed. And by that point, I lost interest.
You'd moved on. Do you feel any like mild PTSD when you hear the words writer's strike, which is happening again right now? You're like, no, again. Or it doesn't matter because that world is not yours anyway.
That world is not mine. And you know what? Like working on set at the time was so much fun. And I can see why people make a living out of it. But it was just like I wasn't deep enough or farther enough along seniority wise to make it possible to come back and. You know, I'd have to start all over again at the bottom of the PA pile. And it's just like, ugh. No way, man. I can't do it. somebody who really wants to work on set could maybe, but oh, man, that'd be going in reverse. And it would be a lot.
So you started early 2000s, right? You started doing stand-up?
Yes. Yeah.
And this was a time, you know, the one thing I really wish, which is weird because I'm not a guy who's got that connection to Vancouver, but every time I hear people talk about this place called the Urban Well, something happens in their eyes and their heads lean back. And it's just like, apparently the greatest time in Vancouver history. And yeah. The Urban Well, at least for a time, I think it was run by Brent Butt.
It was. Yeah.
It was run by Brent Butt. And he would just have his favorite comedians coming through once a week.
Yeah. He hosted two shows because the one show was so popular. He would host two shows every Tuesday. But here's the thing, my whole career and almost every time I do a show, I'm the guy that you tell, oh, last week was so good. I don't know why it's so quiet. Last week was amazing. So that's whenever I go, you should put yourself in the slot before me because that one's going to be the hot show.
Yeah.
So that's the same with the Urban Well is when I started doing it, people were like, oh, if you'd been here a year ago. And I was like, yeah, I guess.
I guess, but I am here now and I'm a human being who has, self-esteem that you could help me with. Yeah, I totally get a ton of that.
Yeah.
I get a ton of that. Oh, last week was amazing. Well, yeah, that doesn't help me.
Was a good show. It was a good time. And like being able to see Brent Butt do two shows a week was very fortunate because you just got to see this guy, master of his craft, work every week and kind of he could really, really go off on fun tangents. And it was great. It was like great and boozy. And, you know, Robin Williams used to stop by there all the time. And like anybody who was in town shooting something or whatever would come by and do a set. And it was good. But it's definitely like, yeah, as soon as I got in, people were like, oh, you know, a year ago, that was the sweet spot.
The worst. I know. And then what were your goals at that point when you were starting with stand up? Or am I applying too much professional, ambition to the Graham Clark of the early 2000s? Did you have goals in comedy? Was there stuff you wanted to accomplish? Or you were just like, this is fun and let me see where this goes?
It's kind of a blend of the two. Like it's let's see how this goes. Cause I've never been like somebody that's like, I got to do this thing. I'm like, I'm interested in seeing where things go kind of organically. But really at the time, what I wanted to do was to be as funny as Brent. Like that to me was the watermark. Mm. And that wasn't just in the city. Like, you know, the more I toured around, the more I was like, oh, this guy's, you know, one of the funniest guys in the country. And then, you know, I went to the States and I was like, oh, this guy's like one of the best comics on the continent. So he was, he was very like, I was like, if I could be good at stand-up like him, that would be fantastic.
What a great mentor to have. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I say, just lucky in that regard. But yeah, the Urban Well, people they wax nostalgic about it. That's for sure.
I got to spend some time with Brent. We chatted here and there, but he interviewed me at the Vancouver Writers Festival.
Oh, cool.
And what a gracious, kind guy too, which is a whole other element that you're not guaranteed that in comedy.
Oh, God, no.
That the best comedians are also the best people, but he was quite wonderful. In fact, at one point I was like, Brent, you've promoted my book more than I have. And we've only been here for 45 minutes and you've already talked about my book. Every time he'd ask me a question. So Ali, when you were writing this book, he would turn to the audience, which you all should buy, by the way. And then he would turn back to me and he kept doing that. I'm like, all right, now they're going to think it's a scam, Brent. You're too kind.
And now he has written a book.
That's right. I wanted to talk about it. And he goes, not. We are talking about you today. I was like, unbelievable. Yeah. This guy's just, an obscenely gracious man.
I have not had the chance to read your book yet, but I've got it on hold at the library.
I mean, you know what that is, Graham? That's a you should have been here last week vibes on that. Here's something. You have a book. I haven't read it, but I know it's out there. Information.
I know it's out there, but I put a hold on it to the library. So.
The hold is good. The hold is good. That's good. I'm also excited that the book is still, there's a list of people waiting to read it. When you put a hold on something, that means there's
people that,
people reading. That's the best. That's the best. And I have a special connection to libraries, just having taken my kids to libraries through the years and
all this
entertainment we got. You know, before there was Netflix, there was the Richview Library in Etobicoke, Ontario, where we would get like nacho libre, and then we would
totally make,
like, tacos and watch these ridiculous, you know, Napoleon Dynamite with the family. And then my kids, like, their reading came out of that. So yeah. I just love it.
And
I'm
like,
very happy.
Just kind of discovered the library in the past like 5 or 6 years and all the things they do. Now you can like record a podcast at libraries. Oh, yeah. And you know, you can use a green screen and all this kind of shit. It's fantastic. Like the yeah. things the library does, nobody
but
else
the
does.
Vancouver Library especially.
Oh, yeah.
Is an incredible, incredible, but very, very modern at the forefront of technology. I did a fundraiser.
Did you?
In a way, I should be saying you're welcome is what I should be saying. I mean, a lot of that stuff that you just talked about came because of the hard work of Ali Hassan in Vancouver.
Well, and that's why there's a wing of the library dedicated to you.
What? They didn't even, I wasn't even informed.
They wanted it to be a surprise the next time you came by.
Oh, God, would I be thrilled.
So I wanted to ask you, Graham, about sure. podcasting. You don't record currently in the Vancouver Library, I do believe. You,
that is correct.
Is that
yeah,
correct?
I didn't record for you.
But you were, you know, it seems like an early adopter of podcasting. Can you tell us a bit about what made you decide to kind of...
And we should let people know your podcast referred to by people in the know, like online.
Sure.
It's Canada's top comedy podcast.
Question mark.
Yeah. With the question mark. There was two question marks, actually, which was weird. It was as if somebody wrote it and they themselves couldn't believe it. No. Zero question marks, exclamation, if anything. And yeah, it's a fantastic podcast. And
you've been a guest on the podcast.
I've been a guest.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was
a guest in the pandemic. So it also did something for my soul, you know?
Good.
I was like,
yeah,
I just need to connect with other human beings and have some laughs. You guys were there for me. And I always do some, you know, kind of research. Research is a weird word. To talk about me listening to Chris Locke on Stop Podcasting.
Oh, it's not really research. So
I just listened to a bunch of people. Yeah, it was a time of great joy.
Good. Thank yeah. I mean, if you thought this pandemic was something, you should have seen the last pandemic. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. That's when it was the golden age, really. Yeah, we were super early in the podcast game. And like at the time, there was, to my knowledge, I think there was like 3 or 4 comedy podcasts, period. Like we like,
which is so hilarious, wow. Because your name is Stop Podcasting Yourself, which is something you would say if everyone and their mom was starting a podcast,
yes.
Which was definitely not the case in 2008.
I know. We're prescient that way. We kind of
so prescient.
Yeah. But yeah, we started in 2008. So yeah, at the time there was like, I think there was, yeah, 4 kind of prominent comedy podcasts, and my co-host Dave. He just thought, you know, comics are so funny off stage. What if we did a podcast? Like at the time, I didn't even know what a podcast was. And I think he didn't really know either. He had kind of a sense that we should do a thing where comedians talk. And I mean, of course, now that is every other podcast is comedians sitting around talking like this, what we're doing right now. But at least you guys have a...
One of us is a doctor. That's how we keep it original.
But that's the thing is now you have to have a concept, which when we started, you didn't. It just was like, oh, 3 people on a mic and that's it. Like there's nothing special about it. There's no shtick. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, we were around, like we predated, you know, Mark Maron and predated like, a lot of the podcasts that people said, like, this is where podcasting blew up or whatever. We were there several years before them. So we've been at it a long time.
And I should mention this too. You are involved with a division of, I'm not sure what the right term is,
sure,
but you're part of the Maximum Fun podcast network. You're the only Canadian podcast on that network.
Yeah.
That network, if people listen to podcasts, Bullseye with Jesse Thorne.
Yeah.
Is that one of my favorites? Jesse Jordan Go is also another, it's an award-winning show with Jesse Thorne as well. Rolling Stone had picked it as one of the world's best comedy podcasts. On a personal note, some of our loyal listeners will remember Dr. Sydney McElroy and her husband do Sawbones. And we had her on this podcast And her husband, Justin, also does My Brother and Me.
Which is a juggernaut. That is such a good show.
Huge. And actually, it was Asif who introduced me to that. And then the more we listened, we were like, maybe we can have Dr. Sidney McElroy on our
show. Oh, that's so cool.
As a doctor. Yeah. So we've been sort of linked in with Maximum Fun that way. And I had always heard about Maximum Fun only through Stop Podcasting Yourself and Jesse Thorne. But it's this incredible treasure trove of amazing podcasts. How did they find you?
Yeah, because like they had a message board kind of before there was a lot of social media stuff, like where, because like now it's social media is like everything, but it was like a message board that you could post about podcasts you like and whatever. And somebody kind of was in a loop of talking about, oh, we really like this one from Canada. And then Jesse Thorne just got in touch and said, would you like to be part of the network? And at the time, their network was Bullseye, which used to be called The Sound of Young America, Jordan, mm-hmm. Jesse Go. Like the McElroys were not around at all. They had an old-timey show called Coil and Sharp. I think that was it. I think they had three podcasts at the time. And now they have like, you know, 40 or something like that.
70, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. So then I want to ask you two kind of questions about podcasting specifically. The first is about how you choose your guests. So, you know, for our podcast, you know, you and Ollie know each other. You guys are friends. So that's one way. And then Sidney McElroy was just a cold call. It wasn't a cold call. Yeah. It was cold email. Just, you know, would you be interested? And I emailed her later. An email from Sidney is like, yeah, yeah, no, that sounds really fun. Yeah, just let me know when and I'll try and schedule it. But how do you get your guests? How
we
do you
try to find people who are already people who do a lot of podcasts so that you can listen to how they are on a podcast so that you can confidently ask. And sometimes like it's just somebody whose act is really funny, or just a lot of times it's I ask somebody for a reference and I just say like, who do you think would be good on the show as well? And so get a lot of people that way. But yeah, it's just approaching somebody that we think, you know, would it be fun to talk to this person for an hour? Mm-hmm. And we're usually pretty good. I think we've nailed it. It's very, very rare circumstances where we pick the wrong candidate. But yeah, very like that's how we kind of do it. We just decide like who's funny, but also who's somebody that you think would be fun to talk to.
The other question I had was about your logo, because when it pops up on my podcast feed, I like stare at it for like, you know, 45 minutes at a time. I love the logo so much. And I keep, and so it's like, I just so curious how you came up with it. So we'll put a link to it.
Speaking of old timey, comes out, sort of like,
what's that? Yeah, exactly. So the podcast logo, it reminds me of the old CBC logo, right? For us Canadians, and how it kind of moved across your screen, and it was orange and blue, right? And then you have these silhouettes. I'm assuming it's you and Dave.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. And then, but they also look old timey. It looks like the drawings from my old choose your own adventure books when I was growing up as a kid. So I'm like, how did this come about? This logo.
And also the logo is shaped like a stop sign. So that's a
Stop Podcasting.
Stop.
Yeah. That's Dave Shumka's came up with that years and years ago. We used to have our podcast just had a picture of the two of us. And then he decided like, I'm going to try and make something so that CBC reference was where it all started, was from that era of CBC, which we grew up with that. That's what CBC looked like growing up, was that orange and blue and red scheme. So yeah, it was just that, like, that's the Canadian thing. The stop sign's the stop thing. And the two people inside, that's the podcast thing. And so, yeah, that was Dave who put it together.
This is way back, because this is when people knew what your chin kind of looked like.
That's right. Yeah.
Right? This is chin gram.
This is a bygone era. We don't, Dave looks the same, but he's got like a lot more, he's got a bigger hairdo. I'm the only one that kind of has just really let it go. You know what I mean? Really let it all hang out.
I mean, you could say you have a bigger hairdo as well.
It's true.
Know if beards count as hairdos, but for our listeners who haven't had the chance to look up Graham just yet, quite a prominent beard.
Yeah.
Down to the middle of his chest. And as I talk about the beard, I do have to give a little plug to a part of your life that I don't know if you're doing anymore, but you used to do these beard paintings.
Yeah.
And then sell them for charity.
Yeah. And I just paused on it for now because during the pandemic, I did a lot of them and I was doing commissions and I just burned myself right out of doing them because doing commissions is way, way, way harder than just doing whatever you see in your head. Because people wanted commissions. A lot of people wanted commissions, paintings of their dogs. And I like I tried my best, but I don't really know how to draw a likeness of a dog. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Some people are, they like, you know, they can study the dog really quick and figure out a way to portray the like soulfulness in their eyes and stuff. And I didn't know how to do that.
That's a lot to ask.
Yeah.
And I should mention, by the way, also, these paintings are not just Graham running his beard willy-nilly through some ink and then onto a canvas. This is, your beard is tied up very nice and neat at the chin and then tied up again a little lower. And you use your beard as a painting brush.
Yes.
It's all much more sophisticated than it might sound in somebody's mind.
Yeah, and it was exactly as you presented. That's how it works. That's how you do it.
But how did you even come up with this? This is like...
It was...
How did you come up with this?
How much weed were you smoking at the time?
It started as all these, you know, everything that you do in comedy always starts with a joke. Always starts with like an offhand comment somebody makes. And
imagine if.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think it was Ivan Decker. Very hilarious comedian, Ivan Decker. I was growing it out, and he said something to the effect of, oh, you could probably paint with that the way that an elephant does, you know, with its, what do you call it? Not its tusk.
Yeah, it's tusk. It's curled trunk.
Trunk. And so I thought that was really funny. So I bought some paint and a little canvas and just kind of, you know, Jackson Pollock'd it. And I was like, oh, I don't know what to do with it. So I put it on eBay. And somebody bought it right away. So I was like, oh, I'll do another one. And they bought it right away. So I just started doing them all the time. But yeah, I take a break from it. I'm thinking of going back to it, but for now, just like taking a break, cooling it out.
Or go back in like no commissions?
No commissions. Yeah. No more. Yeah. Like yeah. I'll paint whatever, but whatever I feel like. But yeah, no more commissions. Too much stress.
They're really good, by the way. Like, I was scrolling through your website the other day, and my kids came upon the one that's of Baby Yoda. And they're like, oh, that's so cute. It's like a good painting. Like, pretty you are painting. Quite talented in this.
Much better than Ali Hassan's bald head painting.
Oh, I doubt that very much.
Those didn't go well. They didn't really.
But you use a bigger canvas, which is harder. You got to fill more. Yeah. You got to run at the canvas.
And my bleeding skull by the end of every painting session.
Yeah.
It really delays the process.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun. It's fun to do. And we'll see if it's one of those things like, you know, Maude Lewis, like she in her life, she just sold little paintings on the side of the road for whatever, $2 or $3. And then now they're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I want to be the next Maude Lewis. That's what I want to do.
I want my work to be exploited for future.
Absolutely. I don't want it to happen else. In my lifetime. Yeah. I want it to happen years and years from now.
Too kind. I was going to tell Asif this story, Graham. And then I was like, no, I think it'll be great if Graham tells it. It's, you had this phenomenal Fringe show that turned into something, you know, longer lasting than just the Fringe, but it was called Graham Clark Reads from the Phone Book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And can you just tell not just Asif, but our listeners, how that came to be a show, where that concept came from?
Like I say, everything starts with a joke, and it was somebody, you know, it was called Graham Clark Reads the Phone Book. So the joke was, you know, that you hear it all the time is this guy's so funny or this guy's so interesting, he could read the phone book and make it watchable.
And it was right.
So that was from a review. And then I thought, boy, I wonder if, you know, if there was a way to kind of take that quote and run with it. And so I did. I just started performing stuff about the phone book all over Vancouver. I'd bring my phone book everywhere with me and just work on bits and pieces until I pushed it out not quite to an hour, but about like to 40 minutes of material, and took it all over the Fringe and had good success with it. It really, like, it won some prizes, and like, I don't do it anymore. I have it on tape somewhere, so I may release it as just a SoundCloud thing to listen to or whatever, but It's
just a sound glitch. You should get a Juno nomination for this thing at least, man. What are you talking about? It's such a great show.
Yeah, it was so much fun too, because then it cycled in on itself, right? Because it was like somebody told him that he'd be funny enough to read the phone book and he'd be funny, and he does. And then, you know, what if he was going to do this? And it just started cycling and cycling like into its own thing. So it was hard to do because that phone book is heavy, right? Like, my hat's off to...
It's quite a prop.
Well, that's the thing, too. Like, I really am fascinated by prop comics. I like, because there's so few of them, and it's so hard what they do, because they bring all this stuff with them from, like, show to show to show, and then have to clean it up afterwards. It's like, it's tough. It's tough to bring, like, one thing, let alone, like, a box of, you know, 10 things or whatever.
Quite a commitment. Yeah. No doubt about it. Yeah, man.
Yeah.
And I recently watched your old Comedy Now special, which is available on YouTube. And I don't think I fully appreciated this, but you enjoy kind of reading these things. Oh, I should let people know that you weren't reading names from the phone book. You were reading ads from the phone book. You weren't just like Eric LaRiviere.
No, yeah. Idiot. It was like,
you were like,
remember when you were a kid and like, this was a thing that it was in the show. If you had a crush on somebody before internet and all that kind of stuff, all your only recourse was to look up their parents' name in the phone book and just stare at it. that was as close as you could get. Like, now a kid could have a drone that like flies by their crush's house.
Absolutely. That's so funny. But in your Comedy Now special, I see you, you know, reading wanted ads for musicians.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is a hilarious bit. He found an ad. I should let people know, Graham found an ad where I think they were looking for like 8 different types of musicians.
Yeah, that's right.
And you were like, so this band doesn't exist yet. They need everybody. This is, you know, usually it's like wanted guitarist who can play acoustic. This is like, you know, cellist,
oboe player.
But it's like you show them, you know, so people are like, oh, these are real ads. So you take something that exists. You had a bed for sale.
That's right. Yeah.
You remember you remember the bed for sale bit?
The producer didn't want me to do that stuff. They were like, no, we don't. Because they wanted everything in that. You did one, right, Allie?
I didn't do a Comedy Now. No, it closed down as I was in contention. It wrapped up.
It was
a real you should have been here last year.
Oh, no. You landed at the right time that you landed after when these things were going. Because they wanted them to be completely homogenous, right? So they wanted everybody kind of have the same outfit and use the same mic and, like, you know, no stool on stage. And so I had to like specially get a stool on stage to put that stuff. And they hated it. Oh, did they hate it? They battled me the whole way with it. Also, I used to wear a hat at that time. They wouldn't let me wear my hat. Like, they just, it was.
And the rigidity is.
And I wore a suit and they were so mad that was the only clothing that I brought, because they wanted me to be in jeans and a button-up. That's what everybody dressed like, was jeans and button-up. And so they were like, no, you can't wear a suit. It was awful. Like, it was just an awful, awful experience.
It's such a poor understanding of comedy and comedians. You get into this business specifically to not be homogeneous.
Yeah.
You have original thought, original approach to life, original ways of dressing and expressing yourself, and they go and squash the very thing that you are. Awful. That's terrible.
Yeah, and it's, man, they sweetened the laugh track too, so it sounded fake. It sounded like every applause.
It did sound fake, but when you were doing your bed for sale bit, which included one of the, you know, it was like, I don't want to ruin it, but it's also a 25-year-old bit. So I feel like maybe it's okay. Graham himself may not remember how it went.
I don't.
But you're talking about, you know, it's like a futon.
Right.
And you're like, oh, a futon bed. Oh, so where could you get one of those except at the corner every single Friday outside of somebody's home? And then there's different things. It has this, this, this. And the last thing was like, slightly brown stain. And you were like, no, you know, you flip it over and you tell nobody about that. You don't say slightly brown. That means somebody tried to rub it out.
Somebody
worked on this. Yeah.
I stand by that bit. Back. That's pretty good.
You bring it back and it'll kill. It was a great bit. and he's reading the thing. And you know how you have numbers that you can pull off, like these signs?
Yeah.
You know, you can pull off the phone number, the little strip, Sosif, like with the phone number on it. Like there was like five phone numbers missing. People are like, what? Slightly brown stain. This sounds pretty good. We could use that at our place. It was great. Such a great bit. But also just reminding me that, oh, your propensity or interest or inclination to read things like that for other people and mine the comedy out of things that we all accept as normal, like the phone book, you know, it's many years old. That's like
it's a long time ago. Yeah. So that's it. We can wrap it up now, guys. Thanks for having me.
I guess, yeah, that's where we peak, right? It doesn't get any better than that.
That's right. But we can wrap up this section in 1 second, but I do want to ask you about this 24-hour comedy marathon. You've done a couple of these for charity. Can you tell us about like how you came up with that and how was that actual experience? I mean, it seems very daunting.
Yeah, I didn't come up with the idea. It was a comedian from Toronto named Pat Thornton, who's a fantastic, you know, star in Canadian comedy. And it's just so, so funny. He did it for a few years as, can't remember the charity. Oh, it's the charity was the Stephen Lewis Foundation. And one of their things that they do for fundraising is they get people to do dares, dare your friend to do this for the charity. So his buddy, Gary Rideout, said, I challenge you to do stand up for 24 hours. And then he did, and it really was popular. So 1 year, a guy that I know had a theater, he had the Havana Theater, and he said, we'll give you the theater and you can do it 24 hours here if you want. So we did it and it worked really well. And then I did it again for the raising money for a place called the Little Mountain Gallery, because that was our comedy space, got closed down. And so they're opening it again, but they needed a lot of money to do that. So yeah, and it's not as hard, but also as hard as you would think it is. Like, you know what I mean? Like it is, it's weird and you're standing, like it's very physically taxing and also like on your voice and just staying up that late and constantly talking for 24 hours straight, basically. And the way that it worked was I had a bunch of comedians, they were writing bits the whole time. So I just have a big bowl and they would throw them in the bowl and then I'd read them and we kind of see which ones got a laugh and which ones didn't. And so it was good. It was a lot of fun, but man, oh man, the body was the thing that got the most tired. Yeah.
At the end of 24 hours, yeah, I've seen Pat's because it was filmed and streamed online.
Yes.
And I watched him in the first 3 hours.
Sure.
And then I watched him in the last hour. And I just remember being like, I went out, I had some drinks, I had dinner, I came home, I slept. And that entire time, this guy has still been doing stand-up comedy. It's insane. It's insane.
It was insane. And I would do it. I think I might do it one more time. But
you got it in you.
Yeah, I think so. Go for the trifecta, right? Go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you able to save the Little Mountain Gallery, by the way, or did it?
Yeah,
close down
it closed and because everything does in Vancouver. So they make way for another condo. And
thank God.
Yeah, exactly. God bless the people who are making condos. But they found a place. They found a place that was, you know, the former owners had to give it up during the pandemic. So there was a place that existed that they were able to move into. It hasn't finished all the renovations, but it's back. It's back and it's going to be fully in business. And it's like Comedy Bar. Like it's our city's version of Comedy Bar where comedians can book their own shows and do the things they want. And so that, yeah. So it is in part, yeah, we saved it. We did it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Graham Clark saved comedy.
That's right.
All right, so we are not often blessed with this situation where our guest stays with us through the medical topic because it is something so near and dear to your heart. And now I say near and dear to your heart, but it also might be something that stops your heart from beating. I don't know exactly, Graham, but we are going to get through your allergies. We're talking about allergies because it is a subject of interest for me. And Asif, obviously, as a pediatric neurologist, will have to deal with kids who have allergies on a pretty regular basis. So we're going to get into your allergies in just a bit, Graham, but let's sort of, Asif, why don't you introduce this concept of what an allergy is. And of course, I am going to ask you in the end, why are so many more kids, why do they have allergies? And of course, I'm very well prepared for your standard, we don't know. So I just want the audience to also be ready for that.
Yeah, we should probably get that out there right now, that there have been an increase in allergies over time. And part of it is, you know, this idea of when you introduce foods. This has been an issue, and it depends a bit, and people's pediatricians or family doctors can talk to them about when for a baby you introduce the food, because that really depends. But it depends if you have a strong allergy history, like perhaps, Graham, is there a big family history for you guys in your family about allergies?
No, like, I mean, not, you know, my family's allergic to cats and like get hay fever and stuff like that, but yeah, not a ton of them.
None of the more serious allergies. So, you know, if Graham were to have kids, and then, you know, you might be more cautious for his kids as opposed to other people who don't have a family history. So part of it is when you introduce things. But again, you know, it can't all be that. So we don't know why we're doing it. There's also a lot more awareness when we're growing up, because I do want to spend part of this time talking about allergy bullying, which is a big topic in pediatrics. So we'll get to that in a second. So food allergies, you know, they occur in about 8% of all children in the U.S., and so similar statistics for Canada. So it is pretty common. Up to 32 million American children and adults will have food allergies. And basically what it is your body has this immune reaction to certain proteins in certain foods. And we know severities can vary, right? Some people can have just a rash, maybe some lip swelling, and other people can be very severe with sometimes nausea or vomiting. And then the most concerning thing is anaphylaxis, right? That is when you have the swelling of your throat, and you can even have low blood pressure, and you can go into shock. So it can be extremely serious and
okay,
fatal.
Can I ask you, as you say, you react to certain proteins in food. Is this a different concept from proteins, carbs, fats? Like, is it a food that actually has to contain protein?
Good point. All foods, you know, contain proteins to a certain extent, or all, you know, it depends on what exactly you're consuming. But most of these ones that we're talking about are mainly protein-based foods that we would think about. Though wheat as well, you think of more as a carb. So there are molecules in that people can be allergic to. I think we all kind of have heard of that. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Well, I just want to ask that also to sort of welcome Graham to this part of the podcast, where I ask some pretty dumb questions. But my hope is that three of our listeners might have been like, oh yeah, that's true. I was wondering that also.
Yeah, I want to learn some things. I don't know too much about the medical side of things.
Okay.
This is good. So I'm going to ask a question to Ali, and you can phone a friend and ask Graham, because he obviously has knowledge of this from his personal medical history. Nine foods, guys, account for 90% of all allergies.
Nine.
You want to go ahead, Ali?
I'm going to start with nuts.
Okay, can you be more specific?
Yes, I can. Peanuts. The peanut is number one.
Peanuts is one, right? Yeah.
And then the other one is tree nuts. Group. Something called tree nuts comes up.
Good.
I don't know if there's other nuts, but I got peanuts.
Not really. Similar family, like legume type things, but seeds and legumes.
I would say eggs. Shout out to my friend Ashesh. Yep. I would say dairy.
Milk. Yeah, good.
Mm-hmm. What else is out there? And these are not like what Graham mentioned, the hay fevers and that kind of, this is all foods.
Yeah. So let's put those as seasonal allergies.
That's not part of the nine.
We're putting
these
those
foods
aside.
Only?
No.
What else is out there, Graham, from your experience, which I believe is extensive?
Shellfish is a big one.
Oh, of course. Oh my God. Yeah. What the heck? Of course, shellfish is a huge one.
And then also just fish in general.
You got it.
Are those two separate categories in the nine foods?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
And then, Graham is a student of allergies after all.
When I mentioned wheat, so we can use that. The other two are a bit less common.
Well, you kind of gave it away by saying peanut legume earlier. So lentils?
Yeah. So this is legume seed. No, you're getting on chickpeas? Close. You guys are.
Tahini? Sunflower seeds?
So tahini is made from seeds.
No,
it's made from
sesame seeds.
Yeah,
exactly.
Of course I know that.
So
tahini is one of those things, you know, you don't think about it. Yeah, the tahini on your shawarma or whatever you have. So sesame seeds. Someone in my high school actually had anaphylaxis and died in high school. I remember clearly.
From a sesame seed.
She had a hot dog with sesame seeds. And the last one we don't think about is soybeans.
Right.
So soy protein allergy. Because some people think, oh, I got a milk allergy, I'll move over soy. And then, oh, I got an allergy.
Right.
Yeah, I even have friends. I have a friend, Vikas, with a sesame, and my buddy Sandeep, it's chickpea. I'm a bad friend.
Well, it's nice that you're disclosing all these in a public forum.
No, this is very, friends. I want them not to die. I think it should be in a public forum, oh, yeah. Shouldn't it? Wouldn't they like this?
I don't know. Yeah. Let's ask Graham. Graham, do you want to tell us? I mean, we're airing your medical history on the air. Do you feel comfortable telling us?
Like, oh, sure. What you're allergic to? Allergic to shellfish, regular fish, nuts, tree nuts, peanuts. Suspected allergy to chickpeas. Like, it seems like I can have hummus, but if I eat like a chickpea whole, I get a blinding headache. Yeah. I don't know what the difference is between the two. What if something gets cooked out during the preparation of it? I'm not sure. And then when I was a little kid, I was allergic to eggs, but I seem to have grown out of that, or that just went away. And then I have a bunch of the other, like, not food-based ones. I have a bunch of those as well. Mm-hmm. But, those, I think that's all. I think I hit almost all of the categories. I suspect that I have a sensitivity to wheat. And I also think maybe to milk, but I drink oat milk and kind of stuff. I still, like, have ice cream and all that kind of stuff, which I'm never going to stop, even if it kills me. I'm not giving that up. Yeah.
Literally.
Feels too good.
Well, you got the, I think you got food allergy much, bingo right there. That was pretty good.
because you paused and I was like, basically, I think you're left with beer and cheese that you can eat. And then you were like, no, wait. Also, I suspect wheat and
And the dairy. Two other guys that would help me out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and can I ask you, what is the severity of your reaction if you were to consume some of these?
Bad, quite bad. I mean, especially like there's some that I haven't had for a long time. Like I haven't had fish, like any kind of fish accidentally, but I had a shrimp accidentally that was not marked. Mm. It was in a wrap that I was told in general, this is okay, you can have this. And I, ate half of a shrimp or a prawn or whatever. And my face just swole up. And I was lucky I had my constant companion is Benadryl, liquid Benadryl. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky that I had that on me. But it was really bad. And most recently, I had a reaction to something. I don't know what it was, but I had lunch and then I came back. Mm-hmm. My face looked like it had been pummeled. So I don't even know what that was. But the shellfish, I found out that I'm still very much allergic to.
When your face is getting swelled, do you feel your throat inside swelling as well?
Oh, yeah. Like, and your stomach's on fire. Mm-hmm. And like,
oh, boy.
You know, you kind of get dizzy and it's a thoroughly, thoroughly unpleasant situation. Okay. Yeah.
So that's a wrap on the day, right? Like you can't continue doing anything.
Absolutely.
That you're.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, boy.
Do you have an EpiPen or have you ever had one?
I have had an EpiPen. My only hold up with having one now is I've never had a reaction so severe that I thought I would need one. And also they're very expensive and they only last, I don't know, 6 months. So,
right. Of course. Yeah. Then it expires.
Yeah. And so it's like not covered necessarily under a provincial health plan or whatnot. So if you're having to buy them yourself, they're super expensive. So I would carry one if I had that kind of like, if peanuts in the air or something like that did it to me, but I'm pretty good at avoiding these things after a lifetime of having them. Mm-hmm. So
Graham touched on something that I find very interesting, which is something you hear from people with multiple allergies. He used the word, I suspect I have this and I may still have this. I found out I'm no longer, it's kind of like this moving target. What is the best way to test and assure yourself that you are absolutely allergic to something or not allergic?
Oh, and I forgot one. I'm allergic to apples, but not cooked apples, raw apples. Yeah.
I've heard of people like that too. Skin only or the meat of the apple, the flesh of the apple would be okay?
I don't know because I've never, I've had it like cooked apples like in a pie or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It doesn't do anything to me. But if I eat a raw apple, it's like, whoa. It's a funky feeling.
Yeah, I know people like that as well. So, but to answer your question, Ali, so you can get the skin prick test. So if you are suspicious of this in your child or as an adult, you can go to the allergist and get the skin prick test. It takes about 20 minutes, and they basically use these small little needles and they prick your skin and they have an allergen and they have a control thing beside it. So, you know, which doesn't have the allergen. And you look to see whether you develop a wheal, which is W-H-E-L, which is this looks like a mosquito bite, a raised red area. And then they'll have, they'll test you for a whole bunch at the same time. Like they might test, one of my daughters, we thought she might be allergic to bee stings, right? Which is another non-food one that's pretty common. Okay, so then you check that. They check a bunch of insect stings. She wasn't allergic in the end. And then they can kind of tell you what that's going on. So did you ever have that?
I had it as a kid a couple of times. And then I had it as an adult. And the allergist was like, shouted out to her assistant to get a stopwatch because she had never seen reactions this big that fast.
Oh my God.
Like she was like, and it was like you say, it's like a little bump form. It was like it was one of those like textured maps, like where you could run your hands over the map.
It all flowed into the other one, basically.
Oh my God.
Wow.
What a great feeling, eh? When you're doing something so historic for a doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been doing this 30 years. I've never seen someone like
you never want to be the interesting patient, guys. Yeah, that's exactly. what we've learned. And it can change over time. That's the other thing too. So you can develop new allergies. You can outgrow other ones. We know lots of people outgrow allergies, but you can develop new ones as you're saying, Graham.
What accounts for this wide range of reactions? Like I would, under other circumstances, I might say that I have a mild allergy to apples, but certainly not in front of Graham. It's insulting to Graham's allergies for me to say that. Like, I get an itchy throat and itchy ears and itchy eyes, depending. And then if I have an apple that's organic, I don't. So I don't know if I'm allergic to some, like the way the apples are treated or what it is, but often that happens to me with apples, not with green apples. I can eat any green apple, but other apples, there's this itchiness. So why does somebody have that? And another person has anaphylaxis. And is there a possibility that a mild allergy can then one at some point become a severe one?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I used to think that, and maybe I learned this in medical school, I just, misunderstood. I used to think if you have a mild allergy, you're good. You don't have a risk of anaphylaxis. But apparently that's not true. There are people who can just have had mild symptoms who can one day later have anaphylaxis, which is why allergists don't like to classify people as even having like mild or severe allergies, especially to food. They just like to say you're allergic because you don't want to say necessarily based on your history that your next one could not be severe. And so I think it's very important if you're suspecting this to get tested and to speak to an allergist and they can recommend, do you need an EpiPen or not? And it is a bit different, I think, maybe as an adult versus a kid, right? Because a kid, they may not recognize the symptoms, like Graham can, and is like, okay, I know myself, I need to pop Benadryl right now before things get out of hand. But if a kid, they ignore it, they're playing on the playground, and then suddenly things take a turn for the worse, right?
I subscribe to the school of walk it off with allergies. Is that a good policy? Like just push through, keep eating the thing, and then you flip to the other side. Is there another side? I know a lot of people are wondering this. This is not just my question, Asa.
I don't know. I don't know if anybody else.
It's funny you should mention that because as a kid, this kind of dawning of treating allergies quite seriously that didn't exist when I was a kid. So there was a real, like, everybody around me would eat peanut butter, use the same peanut butter in the jam jar, that kind of thing was all around. So I was lucky that didn't kill me, but it was kind of this thing, you get a reaction, they'd be like, well, sit down and we'll get you some water. And, because nobody had EpiPens. I don't even know if they had been invented at that point.
Yeah, exactly. You hardly can remember. It was now, my kids who are in school, all the time, they know, they're aware of kids in other classes who have allergies, right? So much more awareness. But you segue, we didn't plan this, guys, but Graham segued perfectly into this bullying topic I want to talk about, which is at this concept of allergy bullying. Like, I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but so we're talking about people who are bullied because of their allergies. And I'll give you guys some examples. But if you look at the data on this, 20% of participants in one study, a Canadian study, said that, I think from Vancouver actually, or Edmonton out west on the West Coast, 20% of patients reported being bullied. And of those who were bullied, 90% reported non-physical acts, but another almost 60% reported physical acts. So like you're touched with the food you're allergic to. Some kids were even forced to eat the food that they're allergic to by the bullies. And there was another study from the U.S. from about 10 years ago where they asked patients and their parents who were there in the allergy clinic about this, and they asked them separately, okay? And they said about a third of the children and a third of the parents, you know, a third of the children reported that they were bullied. A third of the parents said, yeah, my child has been bullied. And again, it's the same thing with threats of food. And they also measured the amount of stress and decreased quality of life that the kids had. And it was obviously very severe. And interestingly, only 50% of the parents knew about the children's bullying.
Right.
You know what I mean? So some kids are keeping it a secret. And, you know, we're talking about, like we said, like, you know, kids who are allergic to milk, milks gets poured on them, peanuts waved in their faces, or peanuts. I've heard about this in Canada among patients at our hospital, like peanut butter smeared on their locker.
Right.
You know, smeared on them. And so I guess I'm curious, have you guys ever heard of this before? Or is it something that was on your radar? Or, I mean, or conceptually, did you ever see it? Or
have you ever done it to someone?
Right. Yeah.
Imagine. Hey, proactive. Graham comes in and starts being like, they won't get me because I'll get them first.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. The best offense is a good defense, or best defense is good offense. I don't know which way it goes. But yeah, no, you know, like, kids are the worst. They're so cruel to one another. And so
they find a weakness and they exploit it.
It's anything. So that doesn't take me any kind of leap of faith to believe that. I very much think that's something that goes on. And yeah, like you say, find a weakness, drill into it as a kid. And for me, when I was a kid, there was, again, there was no broadcasting it. So it didn't, you know, it wasn't that same thing as like, well, you know, this child, everybody has to know that they're allergic to this thing. That kind of puts them in a pretty tight spot that you're like, okay, this kid is weird because of this thing, and we all have to treat this kid a certain way. And then you're like, okay, now you're just asking for it from these cruel kids, you know?
Well, exactly. So I think there's a difference between the U.S. and Canada. So, of course, we, all of us, grew up in Canada. I'll tell you this quick story. So my sister lives in the U.S., and her son, she has her kids make their own lunch. Even when they're young, like 7, 8 years old, they make their own lunch for school. And we adopted that practice for ourselves, so our kids can't complain about what we put in their lunch. We're like, well, you make it then. And then so my nephew was making his lunch, and he's like, I don't know what to put in. And my sister's like, I just make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And my wife and I, who are both physicians, are like, what are you talking about? Like, we can't bring peanut butter to school. And my sister's like, yes, of course you can. And I'm like, no, you're not allowed in Canada. Like, you just don't allow peanut butter in schools. And she's like, yeah, you know what they say in the U.S.? They're like, oh, you have an anaphylactic reaction to peanuts? That's your problem. That's your and your kid's problem. That's not my problem. You're not going to impinge on my rights to eat peanut butter at the school. So part of it is like just this different viewpoint of, you know, the individuality versus the greater good that we often veer to.
Yeah, more in Canada, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there wouldn't be that in America, that kind of school-wide no peanut. Also, you would get bullied because people love peanut butter and they love having peanuts. And if you're told it's all Michael's fault, like, yeah, it's pretty bad news.
kids are awful.
Yeah, they're the worst. Let's stay away from kids.
Stay away from kids.
Oh, well, yeah, you anyways, probably get bullied a lot. So
quit your job.
I thought that's as Graham's saying, oh yeah, they are mean, aren't they, to you every day, I'm sure. Okay, so, well, you know, it's interesting you say this, because in the U.S. their solution, a lot of schools, is there's an allergy kids table. Okay, all you allergic kids, you sit at that table for your lunch and everybody else can sit somewhere else in the cafeteria. I'm like, that's helping at
just
all.
Just a big old bullseye on that table. Oh, God.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so sad. And of course, the U.S. is a bit more litigious than Canada. So there are some lawsuits I was going to tell you guys about. One, a 14-year-old was charged with aggravated assault because it was a classmate who was allergic to pineapple. So they put pineapple on the hand and they gave him a high five. And then that person who gave the high five was charged with aggravated assault. There was another one where a guy, you reminded me of your story. So this was like, I think, an 18 or 19-year-old who, while he was unconscious, people rubbed peanut butter on him and he got such a reaction. It looked like somebody beat him up. Like, that's what it says in the news article. Now, of course, your question should be, wait, why were you unconscious?
Yeah, exactly. Why the hell?
What do you mean? It's college. There's 100 reasons to be unconscious.
Exactly. He was pledging to a fraternity and you're like, okay, well, But again, someone was like charged with assault for doing that. So I don't know. It is interesting. And then the last thing I was going to ask you guys about, have you heard of this? It's a controversy of this movie, this kid's movie, Peter Rabbit. Did you hear about this? It was like from 5 years ago.
Yeah,
it was like, you know, Peter Rabbit and his buddies like harassing the farmer. Like that's the whole thing, stealing carrots and stuff. My kids saw it, never saw it. But I guess there's a scene where the farmer is allergic to, I think, blueberries or blackberries. And so to get back at the farmer, they're using like a slingshot and slingshotting the blackberries into his mouth. And then he has an allergic reaction and has to, you know, use an EpiPen and his face is swelling. Oh, and boy, everything.
That's good. Give the kids, you know, more ideas that they exactly. might not have had.
Use a slingshot.
Well, it was played for laughs. That's how you get those kids at the allergy table. You don't have to go right up to them anymore. Just use the slingshot. Anyway, it was so much so that these allergy associations complained to Sony Pictures. They had to like issue a big apology. But I don't know. It's definitely out there, this allergy bullying. Like,
yeah. It, like I say, it didn't used to be such a wide-ranging thing. You were just told, you know, by your parents, you can't have this, you can't have that. If you're ever offered this thing or, you know, like, because a lot of chocolate bars have peanuts or like mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And you don't know as a kid, you don't know to like read ingredients and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I feel like also in movies, any kind of bad guy has some sort of physical thing to overcome, and it's always the bad guy. It's not the good guy ever. It's, you know, the old man walking with the cane, or the, you know, like you say, like somebody who has like a secret allergy or something. There's always something wrong with the villain.
Yeah, that's right. Those are the evil people in this world, the ones with medical conditions, right? Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly.
That's funny. Yeah, it's so true. I feel like I'll see everything through that lens. I always go through, my first reaction is like the food waste, you know, you rub the pineapple on your hand to high five a kid. No, that's a waste of pineapple.
Yeah,
right?
You know, exactly.
Who's going to eat that pineapple? That's my first thought. I don't like the food waste. But secondly, the potential murder of a child. I was reading one of these articles and it's literally some kid was like, let's see if he dies. You know, like it's just this consequence-free world that kids live in until they've done the most awful, awful thing imaginable.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another article about this lawsuit. It was like Panera Bread, okay? This guy ordered like a grilled cheese. This is a very unusual story. He ordered a grilled cheese sandwich from Panera Bread, and he wrote, you know, no peanuts, allergic to peanuts, on the order. It was like a online order, and they were going to go pick it up. And then the daughter ate it and had an allergic reaction, and they opened it up. And in the middle of the grilled cheese sandwich, which does not come with peanut butter, there was a dollop of peanut butter.
Wow. Do you think they read it and wrong, it's like, and were like, yes, peanut?
No, no. I think
extra peanuts.
Have like, neither of you ever worked in a fast food restaurant with other teenagers? This is very on brand. Right. Usually they're just rubbing something against their genitals and you don't really know about it because nobody has that allergy yet. But
that's
a kid who's not those kind of nuts. This is like a kid who's angry at the world and then was just like, no peanuts. Here's peanuts for you. That'll sort things out somehow.
Oh my God.
That'll rectify the fact that I was never told I was loved by my mother. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's something, it's just anger, misplaced anger coming out for sure. That's all that is. I don't think that's an error. That's intentional.
That was intentional.
Like, screw you and your peanut allergy. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, so there's the whole issue of bullying, obviously, in childhood. And I think what Ollie's point is, you know, when you're doing this to someone with a severe anaphylactic reaction, it is assault. Yeah, you know, that's why some of these cases, again, they're mainly U.S. cases, are taken so seriously. We can do a separate episode later time, Ollie, about, you know, allergy and desensitization. There's some treatments that we can do for allergies, for these more severe allergies. But I think the main thing is to avoid the allergens, right? And sometimes it's easier said than done. So I just thought to conclude, Graham, how do you go about that? Is it, as you said, reading labels, or is it like if it says may contain, you avoid it? And I'm also wondering about restaurants, right? A lot of restaurants just, you know, they may cook stuff in peanut oil and they may not tell you about it. So how do you navigate that in your adult life?
Always, always ask at a restaurant to make sure, even if it's not a listed, you know, if it's not listed as one of the ingredients. And sometimes they just say, like, we have a veggie burger, and you're like, what is that patty made out of? You know, if it's made out of like almond or something like that. A lot of, because I'm a vegetarian as well, a lot of vegetarian food has nuts in it to supplement the like protein that you don't get with it, you know, having chicken or whatever. So a lot of things like that, like salads, I kind of don't rust that much because there's always feel like there's walnuts or something chopped up in the salad. And same with like anything on the menu that you think might possibly have it, always have to ask. And yeah, reading labels. I mean, the thing is, like, there's some products now that have been made in nut-free facilities and have like that official designation. So those are easier to buy than the others, which they may contain. But again, like, I don't, as you were saying about desensitization, I think because I grew up in the era I did, I think I had a greater exposure to these things than what a person would now. So I probably don't have as bad a reaction as some people might. So usually, like, canned contained nuts seems to be fine, but it's a real roulette situation I'm taking. So.
There's one thing. I'm sorry to monopolize more of your time, Greg.
No, this I'm having fun. This is great.
This. Last question on this, Asif. When I was in the UK recently, my cousin has a child with a similar sort of, like, there's like five or six, and it's the big stuff. It's dairy, it's nuts, it's wheat, right? So like getting a sandwich for her, getting a pizza for her, all these things. There's just so much that's off the list. So they were going for what's called a challenge. Are you familiar with that term? You must be. Do you know that term, Graham?
No. Yeah. Yeah, so this is, you need to do this under the supervision of an allergist, usually in a hospital or at a facility where they can treat you for anaphylaxis if it develops, and they'll actually challenge you orally with whatever they think you're allergic to.
See, they bully you. They shove the peanut in your mouth, but it's in a hospital, so it's not called bullying. No, it's microscopic amounts, right? It's like the way a vaccine works. Is that?
So you can do that for certain peanut allergies. I guess we're talking about it now. I was like, we're talking about another episode, but we're talking about it now. So you can do, and this is what Graham was alluding to, by giving these microscopic or small doses over time, you can desensitize your reaction to it over time to eventually get to the point where you don't have really any reaction at all. And so what you do is, you know, often for kids, it'd be like for peanuts, it'd be like peanut M&Ms, and they might prescribe you a certain amount. The thing, it's very important. I cannot stress this enough. This must be done under the supervision of an allergist. And I'll give you two examples. Again, like Graham was saying, peanut allergies are more common now and people are more aware of them. So one of my friend's daughter had a peanut allergy who was amenable to the desensitization. And they went through this thing with peanut M&Ms over time, take this number every day, and then they gave them a schedule. My other friend, whose son is severely allergic, they're like, no way. You cannot do this. If you even get a small amount, you will have anaphylaxis. It's not worth the risk. So we're not prescribing it to you. So this is why you must do this under a doctor's supervision and an allergist who knows what they're doing, a pediatric allergist, because you can't take a chance that you're going to just try this on your own and then you have something catastrophic.
It's also like, I think just on that kind of like desensitizing somebody to a thing, as a kid, you lock it in your head that this is not a thing to eat. So even having the ability to eat it in your brain, it's like, that's like drinking bleach. Like, it's, you're not going to have you're not like wanting to have peanut butter, even if you're not allergic to it. Yeah. Like, that's just gone forever. You're not going to love it. Yeah.
I just heard this for the first time in December. It's very interesting, that perspective. I'm glad you shared that, Graham. I heard that from a buddy of mine who has a death allergy to eggs. And I asked him about the challenge test, which I had just learned about, you know, a day before meeting him. And he was like, man, I'm almost 50. I've gone so long without eggs. I don't know. It just feels weird to welcome them back in after all this time. And it was kind of a mental thing. He was saying, like, I don't, you know, they've been the enemy for so long. You just can't welcome the enemy back into your house that easily, I guess.
Right? Totally. And like, you might make, you know, accidentally being dosed a little better, or, you know, like, but it's just, I'm never going to seek it out. And like you say, I've managed to stay alive this long. So I think I'm fine without pecans or whatever the hell, you know?
Well, Graham, listen, we really appreciate you coming on the show. It was great just chatting about your life and career and the podcast. And it was really amazing having you on this part because, again, you know, Ali and I don't really have food allergies, you know, especially to the extent that you do. And just to hear it from you and to get your perspective on some of these.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I was, when Ali sent me the invite, I was like, oh, I actually have something to say about this particular topic. So this has been really fun for me.
Terrific. GrahamClark.com. You got the .com. With all the other Graham Clarks out there, you still managed to sneak your way in there. But that's where people should go to see where Graham's performing, what he's working on, what he's raising funds for as the, you know, tireless advocate for people who are less fortunate, and to keep abreast of the return of his beard artwork.
Yeah.
Which one day might happen. And that'll all be up there. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see them on beardpaintings.com if you want to just circumnavigate the the website altogether.
There you go. Okay, you could do that. And then, of course, speaking of circumnavigation, if you go to MaximumFun.org, you will find Stop Podcasting Yourself, or you just Google Stop Podcasting Yourself, and you'll see the top Canadian comedy podcast.
Almost 800 episodes of a backlog. Almost 800.
Amazing.
If you like it, you go down that.
You know, good for a long car ride or whatever.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Thanks again, bud.
Thank you.
Thanks, Graham.
So I can't help but think that a renaming of allergy bullying would be in the best interests of everybody, in the sense that, you know, bullying is such a broad, like sometimes some kid just sort of feels othered at school for some reason.
Yeah.
And I don't want to minimize that, but that doesn't qualify as like murder or manslaughter. These are widely different experiences. And bullying generally, you know, in most people's experience, doesn't end with such violent acts and possible death. I just feel like it should be like allergy assault or something like that. I think it deserves another category all on its own. I mean, this is a level of seriousness I don't think you're touching on when you just sort of group it in bullying.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And we call it allergy bullying in the medical community, but I totally agree with you. Like, maybe we should think about renaming it. And that's the whole reason to do this podcast. A, to talk about this and raise awareness for an issue, and to talk more generally about allergies. And of course, it was great to have Graham on because he has the personal lived experience, right, of having numerous severe allergies and how he navigates life, you know, both when he was a kid and now as an adult. So I thought it was great having him on. Really insightful guy.
Terrific. Yeah. You could chat with that guy endlessly. Endlessly. Yeah. I mean, we zeroed in on a couple of things, but he's well-informed and super entertaining and very curious. So a really great guy.
Exactly.
I hope people visit his website, explore his comedy. It is also, a lot of his bits are so hilarious and intelligent that they stick with you for years.
Yeah. Yep. As you said, you still have these ones from his Comedy Now special.
Watched that recently, but yes, that will stick with me for years. It will stick with me for years.
There we go. So reach out to us. Let us know what you guys thought about this episode. DrVComedian@gmail.com. DrVComedian on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We are everywhere. And remember that although I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor, and I'm not Graham or Ollie's doctor either. Medical issues, we talk about it for your interest and information only, and they're not medical advice. Please consult your medical professionals for actual medical advice. Thanks for listening.
Bye.